Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. We're also pleased to have back with us once again James Marchand. He is an emeritus professor of Germanic languages and literature at the University of Illinois and has for some time been good enough to come on this show and take whatever questions people might have having to do with words and where they come from and how they change over time and how sometimes different people in different places use different words to talk about the same thing. And it's always entertaining when he is here. Your questions are certainly welcome. We cannot promise any question can be answered, but I know that he will give it his best shot. And he has a great deal of knowledge and experience in this area, and I haven't seen him fall too many times. So he's been good enough to be here, and we just open up the phone lines, and you can ask whatever questions that you have in mind. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you very much for being here once again.
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's a lot of fun.
We were just... We were talking about subliminal messages before we got going, so we can promise we'll try not to flash any subliminal messages. And I guess it occurred to me that there, and maybe this is getting outside of your area, I thought, in fact, that there was some question about whether or not subliminal messages actually worked, and if they were subliminal enough so that you didn't notice them, whether that then they would be, you would be able to perceive them. And I know people, they did this, somebody claimed to have done an experiment in a movie theater where they flashed up stuff like buy popcorn, and the claim was that then, of course, people rushed out and bought more popcorn, except I'm not sure that actually was true.
Well, I'm not sure. There's a great deal of literature on, subliminal suggestion of all kinds, not just on television, but also in radio and any other medium whatsoever. And there's a lot of, what one might call semi-pseudoscience on it, of the nature of the thing you're talking about. But many, although the Commerce Commission has come out against it, there are still ads on television, if you slow them down, you can see them, for commercial products that have subliminal messages in them. So one, does one's best, I suppose, with such things. But there's a good deal of literature on it. I've never been myself convinced of the value of subliminal messages, but
well, that's very interesting.
And
well,
of course, as you know, we've had that particularly in popular songs, where there are, according to people who are opposed to certain kinds of music, they have subliminal messages, and some of them did, and they were able to show that they did, and so on.
Well, maybe we'll have to haul some psychologist in here too. Talk about that. In any case, here we have a caller ready to go. Somebody on a cell phone, so we better not keep them waiting. We'll go here to line number one there in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for getting me so quickly.
Sure.
I was just reading a recent issue of Time magazine, and I noticed that they were spelling the word elite, usually E-L-I-T-E. They were spelling with an accent over the first E. And for some reason, the word appeared in about six different articles in the same issue where I've never noticed it being featured like that before. What's up with the first accent? Why have I never seen it before? And what is it supposed to be signaling? And I'll go ahead and let you answer that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call.
I think we have a subliminal. That is, what the editors of Time are trying to do is either show you that they know French or that they're elegant, or that this is a first-class magazine, not like those bums that don't spell it with an E, accent aigu, and so on. Of course, it is a word we borrowed from French, but we don't usually put our accent. Sometimes we put them in the wrong place. I've noticed that a lot. And so people who are trying to, it's like people who say, between you and I, which is kind of like holding up your pinky when you're drinking a cup of coffee. You're trying to show that you really are above the people who say between you and me, whereas you actually show the opposite thing. Mm-hmm. So were I Time magazine, I'd give that up.
And if we were French Elite, that would be that would be correct.
Elite.
And, you know, I studied French when I was in high school and remember almost none. And I guess I never could quite keep straight the accent grave and accent aigu, these little marks that one goes one way, one goes the other way. Yeah. I never really was quite sure what one was supposed to do with those.
Well, I guess the most famous one, of course, is the house stop, which replaces the S. You have the accent aigu, which is A, accent grave, which is E, and then you have the house stop, which is E also, but it, like a word like chateau, which is cognate to our castle, would have a house stop.
That's what it's like, a V, up an inverted.
Upside an inverted V. I shouldn't say house stop for that, but we used to always say that.
Well, I know what you mean.
And it's, in French, you say chevron, which means house stop. And so... these accents are quite interesting. Most of the time when we do them in English, we get them mixed up. We don't mind because we're just trying to look fancy. And
so that word, and it's this, the word chevron that we also use for those stripes that are on a sergeant's sleeve, that's where that comes from, and that's what that means? And
it means the roof, that sort of thing. And also used the word for roof, like was a little song. One of the songs that the kids sing in France is Cadet Roussel. And part of that is Cadet Roussel à trois maisons qui n'ont pas tourné chevron, who have neither roof nor nor roof. And but I'm not sure. I would have to go back and figure out what chevron comes from originally. It's obviously a French something, I mean a Latin something like Caperon, so it means the top of the house. What happens in French, I don't want to give you lectures, we don't want to do lectures on philology, but what happens is a Latin CA becomes a French CH. And so if you have something like Castellum in Latin, that becomes French Chateau, because the thing, so if you had some, and actually our English word chief comes from the Latin word caput, which sounds rather strange. But what happened was and also things like, there are any number of those where the C becomes a CH. And so we used to be in French, now you say chef, but used to say chef. We borrow from the Normans more from the French.
So the chef is just the person who's the chief of the kitchen?
Yeah, the head of the kitchen.
The head of the kitchen.
And then that becomes chief, and then, that, you know. It's like words do. We have those same sort of things.
Our guest this morning on Focus 580, James Marchand, Emeritus Professor of Germanic Languages and Literature at University of Illinois. And every once in a while stops by here. We talk about words, where they come from, how they change. Your questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Champagne is next. Line one.
Yes,
hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Two comments. First of all, I always thought between you and I was wrong, because isn't the rule that if you can leave one component out, use the word that's more correct? In other words, you wouldn't say between I, you would say between me and somebody else.
Yeah, you're quite right that between you and I is wrong. That's why I cited it as being the kind of thing like holding up your little pinky when you're taking a cup of tea, which is also wrong. People say between you and I because they're trying to be fancy. That's because they know the language better than you and I do. And so it's a hypercorrection, we call it in linguistics.
Oh, I see. And the other comment I wanted to make, more and more I hear I should have went and similar grammatical errors, and I am just wondering if the schools don't teach that correctly anymore, or what is happening here?
Well, I think the schools may be doing the best they can. Of course, sometimes they miss things too, but what happens is that people just are sloppy, don't think about what they're doing, and it sounds good to them some way. But we have real problems with past participles in English and subjunctives which have disappeared and any number of things like that. So you'll hear a great number of errors, just probably even a lot of them listening to me.
Well, this one bothers me particularly, and I just wanted to say that I'm trying to work against it, but it's hard if you're talking to a friend and a friend uses it incorrectly. You don't want to correct your friend.
You best know. You could do is set a good example.
Yeah, I try to. Sometimes I try to come up with something where I can say, yeah, I should have gone too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Where did, by the way, that elevation of the little finger holding the teacup come from? I've had this discussion with my wife, and she said, where did it come to be that somehow was some sort of sign of gentility?
Well, we had a movement of preciosity in England, the same as they did in France somewhat earlier. And it was thought that you were not supposed to grab your mug with your hand like a male might do, but you were supposed to have a small teacup, maybe a demi-tasse, and so your finger would naturally come up, and that would show that you were elegant. I don't know of any book that ever recommended it, but it was certainly a thing you were supposed to do if you were elegant.
I see. Well, I do see the point that if you had a cup that had a small handle, as demi-tasse cups do, they're not even big enough to get one finger in, so you can't. You have to pick it up that way, and so what else do you do with that little finger but wave it out there in funks? All right, very good. It's an amazing font of knowledge. We have other callers. Lafayette is next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I guess on this I can ask only for a personal preference. If you were confronted with two possible courses of action, would you say that you had a choice or that you had two choices?
Oh, I myself would say a choice, but people very frequently say two choices because I suppose there are two choices out there. Myself, I would say a choice, but then...
I think there's one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a real problem when you're confronted with a dilemma. We say dilemma. There's two of them. So dilemma, if you want to pronounce it. Some people even pronounce dilemma. And so it's certainly true that when you have a crossroads, there are two of them there. It's hard to know, but I prefer saying I have a choice.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And back here to Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was German-Irish, and she had a saying that she hasn't seen somebody since Anna Dubach, meaning a very long time. I wonder if that is in the Germanic language or if that came from Irish or if you know.
Well, it's from Irish, but the problem is I'm trying to get the exact Irish expression. I had Irish ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
None of them spoke any Irish, of course, and they did the same sort of thing, but I'm trying to think of what the Irish expression is. I don't know Irish too well, but I do know that's an Irish expression.
Okay.
My grandmother, by the way, used to always say to me, I'll give you a Bosch Gary, and I wondered why she called me Gary until I learned a little Irish and found out that that's a blow of crying.
Uh-huh.
A Bosch means a blow, as you know, from kibosh and so on.
So would I find that in an Irish dictionary, or would I need to go to some sort of idiomatic phrase book?
Well, probably the best thing to do would be look it up in an Irish dictionary, and, you know, I tell you, you could just, I can give you my email address. And you can write and ask me, and I'll find out. I should know it right off, but, you know. And my email address is marchand@staff.uiuc.edu.
Okay. And would you have a guess on the spelling?
That's the problem. with Irish, you just don't know, because I have a feeling that what you have there is a T and not a D.
Mm.
You know, in Irish, what happens is you the initial letter of a word indicates the case very frequently. So if you have something like, I'm trying to think of any word. Well, our word banshee, for example, mm-hmm. the genitive of that is namna. So ban means woman, but the genitive is mna, M-N-A.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see that if a B changes to an M, and very frequently T's will change to D's,
I always wondered where they got their weird spelling.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to spell Irish because they tried their best to keep it sort of etymological sometimes and so on.
Right.
And so you have also the saying, keli keli, yachen yachen, fat with fat and thin with thin, so that if you had a T that was thin, we don't even have such things. Although if you learn German, you'll find out that their L's are thin and ours are fat. And people will say, hey, you pronounce that funny. So if you say a German word like als, or Hals means neck, and you say Hals, like a person would with an L, they'll think you're saying house.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we have fat L's. But in Irish, everything is either thin or thick. And that's what gives them a problem.
Well, I know where to start. Thank you much.
All right. Sure. Thank you for the call. Right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Just since we've been talking a little bit about Irish here, I'm curious about the state of Irish. I know that people in Ireland are trying to maintain that language. Are there many Irish speakers now? Is that something that's likely to disappear?
Well, I hate to say this, but I think it is likely to disappear. I hate to see any language disappear, and I like Irish. And there are some quotation mark native speakers of Irish, but they're slowly going down the drain too. And English is just taking over. So one doesn't know what to say about the efforts of people to keep it alive. It's like, well, Irish is not as bad a shape as Yiddish, but the efforts to keep Yiddish alive in this country are doomed because it's just gone. Everybody speaks English. And it's good to see these new Yiddish efforts. In fact, the University of Illinois is going to, on Thursday afternoon in the Bread Company, have a Yiddish conversation group. Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock, there will be a Yiddish conversation group directed by Jan Schwartz, and you might want to go to that, anyone who's interested in hearing Yiddish spoken or wants to speak Yiddish.
Very good. Well, we have another caller, and other folks are welcome to call. The number here, again, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller here next is in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, after hearing the last caller, I couldn't resist calling in. I have a grandmother from Pennsylvania, Dutch country, and she used two words that I've never heard from anyone else. The word gornik, which means a lump, if you bang your shin and you get a lump, and the word pogibate, and that's a word for a sweet dessert because it's supposed to be bait to catch poor people with. And I was wondering if you had any clues about that or had run into those types of words from that Pennsylvania Dutch country.
Yeah, actually, the first one doesn't mean what you said it means, although I'm sure it does.
Oh, really?
It means garnished and not at all. And in many of the German dialects, a gornit has come to be just most anything that you want it to be. And so it can be and you have all of that sort of thing. And Pennsylvania Dutch is great for linguists to look at because, for example, our Johnny Jump Up, which is a name for a flower, becomes Jolle Jungbub, which means a jolly rotten teenager. Jungbub means a young booba. Booba means a rotten teenager. And so it's kind of a funny sort of thing that happens with those. And I didn't answer one of yours, and I forget what you said, the second one.
Oh, the second one was pogibate, which was a dessert. And it was actually, it's a little racist. I apologize, but she said it was bait to catch black people with. I said poor people earlier. I apologize that that's a kind of a racist word.
Well, yeah, pogi, though, I'm not sure of that. Well, you got me on that one.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. But now that you mentioned boob, I guess I just heard recently someone make some reference to Mencken, who coined the term the boobwazie. So that must mean that the term boob for someone who is kind of a bumpkin or not very intelligent must go back some ways.
Oh, yeah.
Where does that come from?
Well, I think we borrowed it from German or from Yiddish. You never know about words whether they came from German or from Yiddish or from Pennsylvania German or that sort of thing. But a boob is a... In German, you can still say Bube. In fact, Goethe used it in a good sense. And but also, it's like knave in English and Knabe in German. Knabe is a decent, honest, rather poetic word in German now. And but in English, knave is a scurvy knave. No one ever uses that anymore either. And the same thing happened with Bube, which is an all right word in German, mostly. I mean, I wouldn't call someone that. But it's not a bad word. It just means boy.
Ah,
and,
okay.
And then it gets in English to mean a boob.
Mm. Very good. To Winnebago for another caller here. Line number four.
Hello.
Hello, yes.
You were talking about pogey bait, and that's also a Navy slang word. Means candy bar.
Yeah.
Because you can give somebody pogey bait. A pogue is someone who can be gulled into doing something for you. Mm-hmm. And this is how you bait him into doing it. Mm-hmm. And the other, another Navy slang term is geedunk, which is ice cream in other people's talk. And I wonder where geedunk came from. I never did figure that one.
Well, I'll tell you, these words like Navy slang and Army slang, for one thing, they go so fast. It's quite difficult to know where they may have come from. So even words like Jeep, we argue about because people don't know what's the, you know, the does that come from general purpose or does it come from the Jeep in Popeye or where does it come from? Or Gizmo or any of those which were so popular, let's say, in the 40s. It's quite difficult to know where they come from.
Okay.
They're kind of what we call nonce expressions.
What kind?
Nonce, N-O-N-C-E.
Oh.
And so nonce expressions, you know, nonce for dunce or something.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I guess I had always thought that a lot of those military expressions like snafu were acronyms for some sort of phrase. But it sounds like what you're saying is probably some of them don't literally mean anything.
No. In fact, they're much like a lot of words nowadays. Things happen, and all of a sudden you have a new word, and you haven't, if you're not sitting right there when it's created, you don't know how it came about. Television, of course, is full of words like that you really are stuck with figuring where they came from, and when you know, you happen to... you can't rationalize why did they do that? Why did someone say this particular thing?
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are just like family terms. Like I used to know a family that called the stuff that you make with coffee by putting biscuits in it nunk. I guess from dunking or something like that, but you just said nunk.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of funny words in English that are kind of general blends of one doesn't know why.
Yeah. I guess, it's tempting to assume that, particularly with sailors, because they go all over the world, that they pick up words from other languages that they like and that way they come back into English.
Well, and you also have the situation in Navy talk and Army talk, too, but more in Navy talk than Army talk, that there will be talk which is confined to one single boat. And then if that happens to catch on, it flares through, and then it is from some small incident that happened, heaven knows when. And
so the etymology might be lost. You'd never know where that word came from.
But you can always make one up.
Yeah, and usually they're better than the real ones anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But midway through here, our guest Jim Marchand, he's an emeritus professor of Germanic languages and literature at University of Illinois, and every once in a while is here on the show. We talk about words and language, and your questions are welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, again, someone here locally in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question about the use of apostrophes for plural. It seems like I've been seeing this more and more lately on signs for tomatoes or whatever, and in students' papers, the word Nazis comes to mind. I guess sometimes with an unfamiliar word, people want to mark it off with the apostrophe. I've had a disagreement with a friend of mine. I say that it's wrong in every case, and he says that in certain cases, say, with POWs, for example, that it could be useful or appropriate. So I wanted to see if you thought that, one, that it that there are cases in which that would be seen as grammatically correct, and two, if you see any kind of trend to this usage, and if there's, you know, if one could say that if people are using it more, then it becomes, in some sense, okay or appropriate.
Yeah, I think that what has happened with the apostrophe is one learns it in school and doesn't quite get the rules straightened out. When do you use apostrophe S? In fact, your friend was right about POW. If it's after an abbreviation, I'm quoting the Chicago Style Manual, if it's after an abbreviation in caps, you use an apostrophe to, I guess, indicate the difference from the abbreviation and non-abbreviation. So there you say POWs, whereas actually that's wrong. You should, the Germans always write PSAV because they think prisoners of war, so you get a P, small s, O-W. It looks a little funny, but they'll say Die Sprache der Psov in Amerika and that sort of thing. But what has happened is that we don't know quite when to put in an apostrophe. Sometimes, like, for example, if you have its, you know if that's short for it is, you put in an apostrophe. If it means possessive, you don't, except your students don't know that, and they just stick them in.
Yeah, well, that's, of course, the classic case. It's an its.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's what has happened. Of course, that's from a mistake. In the old days, in the 17th century and 18th century, people thought that it was just sloppy when we said John's hat, for that was sloppy for John his hat. And so we started putting in an apostrophe for what is an Indo-European ending. So we have John apostrophe S. I don't know what they thought about Jane's hat. I guess they didn't think about that. So we have many of our errors, quotation mark, in English come from school teachers of the late 17th, early 18th century.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, and to Robinson for another caller. Here, line two.
I'm sorry I missed the opening remarks of the second preceding caller. Something about Navy usage. I have a curious remark to make about pogey bait. When I was in the Navy in World War II, it was defined as candy based upon the old sailing Navy when the older sailors would stock up a supply of candy to take on a long voyage to use as bait to entice cabin boys into their berths for sexual favors.
Hmm. Well, I know the first part of the etymology, which the previous caller had mentioned, that pogey bait is candy used to entice, lure, or whatever, pogies, whatever purpose one had for doing that.
Maybe I can elucidate that, too. There is Oxford English Dictionary has pogey as a kind of fish, otherwise called the menodon, so it might have been fish bait to start with.
Yeah, I think actually, though, that the a previous caller was right that pogey is a racist term for black people or what should we call them, natives, not necessarily black, but natives. The Oxford English Dictionary should have given that also.
My copy does not.
Well, I have mine on CD-ROM now, so I don't. Use the big one, which is hard to look through, but they should. I'm sure they don't, though, because they frequently miss things. And also, if you look at the etymologies, one of the games we used to play in graduate school was taking the etymology back 100 years. You couldn't win unless you could show a case at least 100 years before.
One additional comment, your remark about the apostrophe for John's book. I own an ancient copy of a great-grandfather's book on the flyleaf of which he has written John, his book.
Yeah, Benjamin Franklin used to always sign his books, Ben, his book.
Uh-huh. So it was not simply a schoolmaster's...
some schoolmaster had taught him to do that.
Yeah.
We frequently do that sort of thing. For example, we say, I would rather... rather than I had rather, because the schoolmasters thought I'd rather, the d must be would rather than had. And so they taught people to say that. And now we all say that.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And continuing to Bloomington, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned the word snafu a while ago, David. You said it was an acronym.
Yes.
And from what I understood at the time, it was situation normal, all fouled up. And the fouled was a euphemism for another word.
Yes, one of those we can't say on the radio.
Yeah.
Indeed. And I don't know how many people know that. That's a little before my time. I probably only know that because I read it somewhere.
That was what I understood at the time.
Yes, and yes, that was what I understood, too.
Professor Marchand, mm-hmm. You mentioned about the German word Bube, and you mentioned that it was boy. Well, that's what it was. I understood it, too. My grandparents spoke German, and they used to call me Bube.
Yeah.
And all it meant, as I understood it, was just boy.
Yeah, and that's what it still means in German. But, of course, you can use it to mean most anything you want to, just like boy in English. And so it, in certain expressions in German, it can mean, you know, rotten teenager and that sort of thing.
David?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir?
I'm having an extremely difficult time hearing on the telephone what is being said. Is there something wrong with the with your lines or something?
Not that I know, and Brian, my engineer, is shaking his head. I don't think so. If other callers are having that problem, they can let us know and we can check it out. But as far as I know, everything's working the way it should be.
Well, it seems so to me. I can hardly hear you, and my hearing is fairly good.
Well, my apologies. If it turns out that's a problem, we'll get it checked out.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for calling. We will continue. Let's see who we have next. Caller in Taylorville, line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to a few comments, but I have a couple of questions about dictionaries. But one of the comments is nobody uses the words seemingly lay and lie correctly anymore. You even hear the president talking about he's going to lay down. I find that just appalling every time I hear somebody almost nobody, but not 1/10 of 1% of people use those words correctly anymore. If that many, maybe it's nearer to 1/100 of a percent. It really disgusts me. There's another thing. I find lots of extra syllables in words nowadays that, per my Webster's Second International, are not in those words. And I wonder where the hell that came from and why. Mencken, with reference to the boob, he had lots of wonderful confabulations, so to speak. Among which are Homo boobians, boobus americanus, and he called politicians boob bumpers. I think we're into the heavy-duty boob bumping season right now. And one of his loveliest lines, I think, one of his funniest, doesn't have much to do with boobs, but it's so funny, I thought I'd lay it on you. He's talking about writing about certain bohemian students. Who think it a devilish adventure to victual in cellars, read craft abing, and stare at the corset scarred nakedness of decadent cloak models. I know that Webster's Third isn't much highly thought of by people like Dwight MacDonald and quite a few other, including myself. Language that's really not just ungrammatical. I would go so far as to say anti-grammatical, and I wonder your opinion on that. And I wonder if on sources for old words, I've got an OED, that two-volume thing that you need a magnifying glass. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's any other dictionary you could recommend, because there are certain words I've found in my reading that aren't in there. And also, I'm wondering if there has to be a dictionary of Yiddish slang. I just love words like schmendrick. By the way, I wonder if you could tell. I know it's a certain type of stupid person. They seem to have upwards of a dozen words for dumb cops. What exactly the word schmendrick means?
Well, last I don't know. Shmu is used in Yiddish. For any, that's the reason we have so many of those in Yiddish, and I suppose to just say dummkopf is just as good as anything else for that. What happens when you get these shmu words in Yiddish is they get to have every kind of meaning you can think of, because everybody uses them. They know that they mean bad or stupid or something like that, and so you can take any word almost and put a shmu before it and make it into a funny kind of word. And of course, Yiddish has the misfortune that a lot of people who don't know much Yiddish use it a lot to avoid saying the words in English. So if you take the words that we were just talking about that you can't say over the radio in English, you can say them in Yiddish. Nobody will even know what it means. I mean, so you can say putz and futz and stuff like that in Yiddish. I mean, over the radio, because nobody knows that those are four-letter words in Yiddish. Actually, they have only four letters. Actually, they're double four-letter words. But anyway, talking about dictionaries, there are, by the way, a lot of – there's even a dictionary of Yiddish called Slang Dictionary of Yiddish. So there are a lot of dictionaries like that that give you the Yiddish, like Harry Golden and people like this, you know, for 2 cents plain. What's the name of his most famous book? Yiddish for something. It has Yiddish in the title. Harry Golden's editor of a newspaper in South Carolina. Dictionaries, it's quite difficult to recommend one. The OED is probably the best, although I did the etymologies for the Random House, and so I feel kind of attached to them. I wouldn't say that they tried to get all the words in the world, though. I used to sit and look kind of with dismay at their big, long computer sheets, though, that they would send me.
About the misuse of the words lay and lie and these extra syllables, words that used to I can't think of an example right now, but I hear them.
Oh, you hear them all the time. Preventative is an example.
Yeah.
Athletic.
Yeah.
In fact, I sometimes shrink when I hear athletic because I think they've made a mistake or something, because everybody says athletic. And the lie and lay and sit and set and things like that, he's just going to sit him down. You hear that all the time. And so this is a common sort of thing. We have lost all the causatives in English. We have just a few causative verbs like drink and drench and sit and set and lie and lay. And since we have so few of them, I'm sure that they're going to just get mixed up and slowly disappear.
It's disgusting. Yeah. I like tradition. I'm kind of fond of tradition. Not that I'm fond of things revolutionary, but I've taken up too much of your time.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. So you think that that lie will only use that for the untruth, and that lay will, no matter whether you're going to lay down or lie something down, it's all going to be lay sooner or later?
I think it's just going to get mixed up. That is, lie is going to stay to talk, say an untruth. It's going to remain. But we're going to get lie and lay just mixed up. Like mad, like we already have.
I think actually I did it wrong myself there.
And and sit and set and all of those are just, going down the drain. I noticed that already in German, too, where there we do have many more causative verbs. But we're giving up on causatives in English.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is James Marchand. He's an emeritus professor of Germanic languages and literature at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while he's here and we talk about words. And your questions are welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign. It's line one. Hello.
Did you say line one?
Yes.
Yes, hi. I called earlier, but I had to call back because of the Anno Tobak. I am German, and the caller was wondering where this was coming from. because he heard his Irish-German grandmother use it. And it's still very much in use in German language. As a matter of fact, I went online as I was listening, and I found 17 pages in the search engine with remarks on Anno Tobak. Now, I looked in my German dictionary, the Duden, and it didn't explain where the Tobak came from, except it said it's another version of Tabak, tobacco. And it doesn't make any sense why you would say in the year of the tobacco to mean something that happened a long time ago. So maybe it is from the Irish, but I just wanted to add that it's still very much in use in the German language.
That's interesting that there it is with a T, and one might expect that. I don't know the expression at all. Of course, that doesn't mean that much. I mean, one doesn't always know expressions.
It's T-O-B-A-K, as opposed to the German word for tobacco, T-A-B-A-K.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's probably about as far as we could comment.
Yeah. Just wanted to add that.
No, very good, very good. I appreciate the call back. We'll just continue to next, moving over to Urbana. Line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. If one were to perform some of the stories and tales from the early volumes of the Journal of American Folklore, where would you suggest the storyteller look to find some recorded examples of the archaic American language, particularly the Piedmont rather than New England?
Well, I would say the best thing one could do right now would be to look at Mencken. And if Mencken doesn't have it, look at Raven McDavid's one-volume example of Mencken. And of course, there is American Folklore Society. There's the PADS, Publication of American Dialect Society. All of those would have examples. And the American Dialect Atlas doesn't intend to, but a lot of times it does because they have a tendency to be out of date. I mean, be archaic because they would like to be. But as to performance and everything, there are just a million places to go. You might start off with somebody like Stith Thompson, who has a book called The Folk Tale, and that has a lot of bibliography in it, and or anything written by an old friend of mine. I'm trying to think of his name. Archer Taylor would be very good. Archer wrote a great deal for various and sundry folklore societies.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
I'm taking the positive view here that languages like Yiddish and Irish are not going to go out of existence.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear you.
Right, because it's just too much fun to do esoteric languages, and the pleasure principles were at that. Thank you very much, Jim.
All right, thank you. Well, I think there will always be a few people who will try to keep them alive. I don't know how many speakers, when we get to the point, how many speakers of Yiddish or Irish there might be.
Well, and you have revivals, too. The trouble of it is when a language ceases to acquire native speakers, it's dead. Mm. You can revive it by having learned speakers like me, for example, or such as I. In that case, it would have to be me because I said having. So you have to worry about these things. Anyway, but I'm supposed to be talking about origin of words and not usage anyway. So that's one of the problems. We have a revival of Cornish. There are people who actually speak Cornish, but they're not native speakers or anything. They're people who go to an island once a year and speak a dead language. But sometimes dead languages can get revived, Hebrew being an example.
All right, very good. Let's go on to Urbana again. Line three. Hello.
Hi, I have two questions. The first one, if one said, all of us, including me, that's correct, right?
I think so.
I often hear people say, all of us, including myself. Is that also correct?
I think that's correct, but what it is a chicken out way. You hear a lot of people who will use the self because they're not sure about whether to say I or me, and they can use a self word. An example, of course, is Michael Jordan, who will do that all the time.
All right. The other one is I actually had a book I read to my daughter, and it was called I Wish I Was Sick. And I thought we said were when we used the word wish. Is that, am I incorrect? I went through and crossed out all the was's well, and changed them to were, but I never really knew except just falling back on what I had learned as a child.
No, you were correct in a way, that is, you were right and was wrong. The problem is that if you're writing a book about little kids talking, they're likely to say something like, I wish I was sick. And so this is, I suppose, an attempt to indicate that. But the subjunctive is disappearing in English. You just listen all the time. And we also have funny things. We will have would have for, like, if the shortstop, if he would have kicked the field goal, we may have won the game. It's a very common sort of expression. There you have two errors compounding each other. But what has happened to the subjunctive is disappearing.
It should have been would have, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, if he had. If he had kicked the, he might have won the game. If he had kicked the field goal, he might have won the game. But we say if he would have kicked, because a lot of people say if, you shouldn't use a would have in an if clause. But they do it because there's no subjunctive around.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. I guess I thought that it was incorrect to say, for if I had said, join Professor Marchand and myself for the radio show. This is one of the things that bothers me. But would you sanction that?
No, I wouldn't sanction it. I wouldn't say, though, that it was incorrect. It's grading.
Yes.
So it's
yes.
Not grammatically incorrect. It's like being socially incorrect.
I see. It's the equivalent of the little
finger. It's not very good.
All right. Let's do one more here. Chicago, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I want to talk about the word schmendrick that was brought up earlier. That basically means kid, and it's usually meant with affection. One of my aunts used to refer to my kid brother as Schmendrick, to address him as that. But as with many words in Yiddish, it can have a double meaning, and it could be used with sarcasm or with irony. Somebody might be referred to as a Schmendrick as being wet behind the ears.
That's the problem with such words. And family words and familiar words and fond words, like, let's see, I guess this is Sanofish. So I knew somebody used to call his kid Little Stinkpot. Now, obviously we know what that means, but it seemed he was very fond of the child, and so you can do all kinds of things.
Yeah, with regard to whether or not Yiddish will last or anything like that. I was brought up, Yiddish was my first language, although I was born in the United States. My mother being illiterate and not knowing English for the most part, and my father being out of the house most of the time working. And so that's all we spoke until I entered kindergarten. And it's pretty much a dead language beyond the second generation in the United States, except for the Hasidim who use that primarily as their spoken language.
Yeah, it's true that you can go to. I used to go to a camera shop in New York, and the fact that I spoke Yiddish enabled me to get a little better deal on the cameras because that was run by Hasidim. And they spoke Yiddish like mad.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies, but we've used our time. I'm sure on another day our guest will come back. So once again, thank you very much.
It was a lot of fun.
James Marchand, he's Emeritus Professor of Germanic Languages and Literature at the University of Illinois.